Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and thanks for listening to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. I'm David Gottlieb. The resurgent interest in Yiddish as a language, as a culture, as a realm of academic study has yielded numerous compelling works of scholarship. A recent and jubilantly subversive entry into this category has been offered by Eddie Portnoy, author of Bad Rabbi and Other Strange But True Stories from the Yiddish Press, published by Stanford University Press in 2017. In this volume, Portnoy, academic advisor and exhibitions curator at the YIVO Institute for Yiddish Research, displays prodigious powers as a researcher and as an historian, archivist, and celebrant of the passionate and tumultuous world of Yiddish cultures in New York and Warsaw in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Portnoy calls this world Yiddish land, a nation unto itself in which all the high and low expressions of culture not only occur, but are carefully and colorfully relayed by Yiddish journalists, including, among others, the young Isaac Basheva Singer. Portnoy notes that nothing like Yiddish journalism had ever existed before, nor has anything like it existed since. Nothing has matched its irreverence, its immediacy, and its wry wit. Neither social media nor personal essays nor good old-fashioned print journalism seem to capture the pathos, the piety, the hilarity, the violence, and the literary brilliance of this vanished world. This Portnoy has done not in traditional academic style with copious notes or dry prose, but with an eye for detail and a deft and humorous touch. Eddie Portnoy joins me to talk about his book, Bad Rabbi. Mr. Portnoy, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background, both academically and personally, and how you came to be interested in the world you call affectionately Yiddish land?
Sure. The way I got into Yiddish was really via my grandparents, all of whom spoke Yiddish. But especially my father's parents, who I spent an enormous amount of time with when I was a kid. And very often they spoke Yiddish, and I would answer them in English. And at some point during my early teenage years, I would go to my grandmother's house and follow her around with a piece of paper and a pencil and asking her what different things in the house were. And I would make little lexicons of words in Yiddish, writing in Roman characters. And when I was in high school, my father bought me a book called Der Yiddish Lehrer, which was a little Yiddish textbook. And I taught myself to read and write using this little text. And my mother's mother was an early supporter of the Yiddish Book Center. And she used to get these little typewritten lists of books of duplicate books they would sell, and I started buying children's books just to have something to read. And it was something that I had that was just a hobby. And sometimes I would go to friends' houses and their grandparents would be there, and I would speak a little Yiddish with their grandparents, and who were always really impressed that someone my age spoke this language. And when it was a hobby that I maintained all through college, I was an English lit major. I didn't really do Jewish studies, and it was something that, you know, I didn't really tell my friends about it. I didn't think they would be interested. And when I moved to New York in the early 90s, I worked for a small publishing company that did projects on microfilm. And we got involved with a project, Microfilm Yiddish Newspapers, from YIVO. And I had to have meetings with people from YIVO, which I hadn't heard of. My grandparents weren't academics. They had no familiarity with YIVO. They were, you know, just regular, you know, tog tegel chayidin, or, you know, everyday Jews, as you'd say. And so I had to have this meeting with the chief librarian of YIVO. His name was Zachary Baker. And we just to talk about the project. And I happened to tell him at this meeting that I had this longstanding interest in Yiddish that I had taught myself to read and write. And, you know, it had been a sort of a hobby of longstanding. And he said, well, you know, you might be interested in taking YIVO's summer Yiddish program at Columbia. It's no longer at Columbia, but it was at the time. And I looked into it. I wound up taking a leave of absence from work. And I took the YIVO summer program. And I was completely hooked. I enrolled in graduate school the following fall. And the rest is kind of history. I always tell people that I turned a fun hobby into a low-paying career.
And what led you then to writing this book? I understand that your dissertation was on Yiddish cartoons. Is that correct? So you must have spent a lot of time looking at microfilm of Yiddish papers.
Right. That's exactly right. So my dissertation was on cartoons of the Yiddish press, and that required me to look extensively at Yiddish newspapers. I also had a side job working for the Forward, doing a column called Forward Looking Back, which was really an unsigned column, but it was snippets from the Yiddish paper, from the Yiddish Vorwärts, from 175 and 50 years previous. And that required me to, you know, read the papers even more extensively. So I was constantly in front of the microfilm reader, you know, looking at Yiddish newspapers from mostly Warsaw, New York. And what happened was through the work for the Forward, and also through my dissertation work, I began discovering really the riches of Yiddish journalism. I began finding stories that were really unlike anything I had read anywhere else. And it was something that, I mean, I don't know if you've ever done microfilm research, but it's not the most engaging thing.
No, it's numbing, and it can be kind of hypnotizing too. You know, you can fall into a trance and have wound through an entire role.
Right, right. Plus, if you're reading microfilm in Yiddish, you're scrolling right to left, and you're reading left to right, and so it's kind of like reading upstream. It can become sort of visually exhausting, but I was so amazed and engaged by these stories I was finding, I would spend, you know, 6-7 hours in front of microfilm readers, just, you know, looking for these stories. And you know, really one of the odd things is, and I describe this briefly in my book, the cartoons in the Warsaw Yiddish papers only appeared in the Friday editions. And so I only needed to find cartoons for the dissertation project. And so I would scroll from Friday to Friday. I would try to skip everything between Fridays because I didn't need to look at it because I knew cartoons weren't there. So, one time I scrolled and I landed a bit early, and there was a headline in front of me. I landed on a Thursday, and the headline in front of me was, Two Wives, Blazing Punches, and the Cops. And I thought, okay, that sounds like an interesting headline. I'll read this short article. So it turned out to be about a Hasidic guy in Warsaw who had fallen in love with his wife's best friend and married her, setting her up outside of town in her own apartment. And he would shuttle between the two women, telling the first wife he was away on business when he was visiting the second wife. The neighbors of the first wife figured out what was going on. They told his brother, who was an in-law to a major Hasidic Rebbe, and the brother arranged for a hearing at the rabbinical court, and he literally dragged his brother there. And waiting were a panel of three rabbis, both wives, and about 30 members of the first wife's family. The rabbis ruled that he had to divorce both women, which they did on the spot. When the divorce was finalized, the brother ran over to him, punched him in the face. The 30 members of the first wife's family jumped on the second wife and began to beat her. The rabbis ran out and called the police, who came and arrested everyone. So I read this story, and I'm sitting in front of this microphone reader, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, that's an incredible story. You know, it is, yes.
And I believe the story is in your book, isn't it?
And, you know, not only is it an amazing story, but it's really unlike the Jews I've been taught about in graduate school or in life. I've never heard of stories like this. I've never read stories like this. It's, you know, this is total, you know, it's like Yiddish pandemonium. And so what I did was, from that point on, instead of flipping from Friday to Friday, as I'd been doing, just looking for cartoons, I began scrolling slowly through the microfilms, scanning for headlines, looking for, you know, sort of juicy stories that I would just make photocopies of and, you know, put aside and save for later. And the later was, you know, this book. I tend to call this book my dissertation detritus. It's the stuff that I found, you know, during my research that I thought would come in handy later on, or I was just, you know, kind of intrigued by it. I didn't really know what I was going to do with it. But the stories are really compelling, and they reveal a kind of, they reveal aspects of Yiddish speaking Jews that, you know, people really don't expect. They don't anticipate Jews like this. I think that there's a lot of nostalgia about Yiddish speakers, and, you know, what I've found really doesn't fit into that framework.
I was going to ask you about that, because it does seem that the considerable amount of studies that have been done on Yiddish culture have really not generally explored what you might call the seamy underbelly of the world, which is teeming, it seems, with rich, colorful characters, obviously a great deal of pain and pathos as well, but a certain kind of wonderful communal feeling, passionate individuals, scenes that seem to make, for example, the Three Stooges make a lot more sense. I mean, it seems like in a lot of the stories that you tell, violence was a principal form of communication, really. Why do you think you said that you hadn't really encountered much like this in your study. Why do you think that is, and what is it about Yiddish culture that makes these stories so possible and so numerous?
Right. Okay. So, you know, one of the significant aspects of Yiddish studies is Yiddishists and people who love Yiddish have long been trying to elevate the language because it was denigrated for so long by so many people as a jargon, as something that, you know, wasn't capable of transmitting intelligent thought. Yiddish, you know, even people who spoke Yiddish, you know, would claim it wasn't a language. So there's been a really concerted effort over a long period of time to elevate the language and give it, you know, greater, you know, sort of intellectual and artistic and cultural status, which it does have. You know, Yiddish is a language of, you know, it has its high literary moments. It has, you know, amazing expressionist poetry. There's, you know, everything. That's one of the things I try to convey in the introduction is that, you know, everything existed in Yiddish from high to low and everything in between. And so what became obscured was the really low levels of Yiddish culture. And that's what I try to evoke. That's, you know, what I really found in this newspaper reporting. And, you know, you note the violence and in fact the Three Stooges. And what's funny is if you watch the Three Stooges, especially from the 1930s, there are a lot of Yiddish. There's a lot of Yiddish in those episodes. You know, they were all of them were the children of Yiddish speaking immigrants. And so, you know, there are a lot of Yiddish moments in the Three Stooges as well. You know, the Jews, as a societal underclass, behave the way that, all societal underclasses behave. They live haunch by jowl, and violence breaks out on a hair trigger. It, you know, people pushing and shoving and slapping were all parts of social discourse. This is not genteel, middle class and above discourse. This is, this is the working class.
You paint that especially beautifully, really, when you talk about, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right because a Yiddishist I'm not, Krochmalna Street, which seemed to be a whole world unto itself. Can you talk about where that was and what distinguished that place from other places in Yiddish Warsaw?
Right. So Krochmalna Street was, and in fact, Isaac Bashevis Singer writes pretty extensively about Krochmalna Street because he lived on it. And it was a street in sort of the heart of Jewish Warsaw. And it was one of the poorest streets that had all kinds of people on, living on it, working poor, but also, criminals and prostitutes and, really sort of a panoply of the Jewish poor. And there was, in fact, a certain stretch of the street that was called called Das Plätzl, or which in Yiddish translates as the little place, and it was, I believe, 9 through 11. The address is 9 through 11 Krochmalna Street. And what's interesting is Bashevis Singer lived across the street at number 10. And these two buildings were sort of a center of criminality, and they provided for Jewish journalists this kind of very rich tapestry of Yiddish speaking Jews that they could mine for all kinds of stories, and they did. And so people like Bashevis Singer, he uses Krochmalna Street in his especially in his book In My Father's Court, which is sort of an autobiography of him growing up on the street, and you get to see the street through his eyes as a child. But it was this incredibly, it was this place where sort of Jewish urban folk culture was very rich, and everyone knew it. And it was, and Yiddish journalists, loved to report from there. They were, there was always something going on. There was always a story to report from on Krochmalna Street. I mean, there are other areas that get reported on in similar ways, but Krochmalna became really a center and a well-known place for this kind of activity.
What led to the sort of explosion of Yiddish journalism? Was it, the cheap availability of printing technology? Was it the relaxation of restrictions on Yiddish language publications? In the case of New York, was it, the upsurge in immigration? Did all these things figure in, or what were the main factors that led to the profusion of reporting on day-to-day Yiddish life?
Right. Well, it was all of those things, and and it happens differently in different places. So, in the United States, you have this very large wave of immigration that takes place in the beginning of the 1880s, where between 1881 and 1924, it's estimated that about 2 million Jews, almost all of them Yiddish-speaking, came to the United States from Eastern Europe. At the time, the only form of mass media is the press. So newspapers completely dominate. And this is, this is where people get all of their information from. In Eastern Europe, it was slightly different because up until really 1905, the Russian government maintains a real stranglehold on newspapers. They do permit some of them, but there's no real profusion like there is in the United States until after 1905. At that point, Warsaw becomes the center of Jewish culture. Previous to that, there had been Yiddish and Hebrew newspapers allowed in places like St. Petersburg and a bit earlier in Odessa. The reason being was that St. Petersburg as the capital was the center of culture, and because they wanted to censor and keep an eye on Yiddish newspapers and Hebrew newspapers as well, this is why they allowed permission for them to appear in St. Petersburg, where there were very few Jews. And in fact, most Jews were not even permitted to live. But after 1905, after the failed Russian Revolution of 1905, Warsaw really becomes the de facto center of Jewish culture, and you have a profusion of newspapers there. And by the time of independent Poland in the 1920s, you get three to four daily newspapers in Yiddish. And in New York, you get even more because the economy is better. So you have up to five daily newspapers in New York in Yiddish. And this is not, you know, without mentioning the fact that in Poland, for example, you have lots of provincial newspapers, you know, newspapers in smaller cities and even smaller towns. So you'll have newspapers in Lodz and Krakow and in Pinsk and in all kinds of other places. In the United States, you have Yiddish newspapers, everywhere there are, you know, significant populations of Yiddish speaking Jews, whether it be Detroit or Chicago or even Milwaukee, Los Angeles, wherever, because print media is the only form of mass media, this is what's, this is what becomes prevalent.
And in Warsaw, we're talking about, at its height, the Yiddish speaking community was about a third of the city in terms of population, wasn't it?
Right. It was, something like 25% to a third of the city. In New York City in the 1920s, about a quarter of the population was Jewish, most of them Yiddish speaking. So these papers and the neighborhoods that were heavily Jewish were so Yiddish infused that in a lot of cases you had Gentiles who spoke Yiddish because they had so many dealings with Yiddish speaking Jews that they learned Yiddish because that's how they needed, that's what they needed to communicate. They couldn't read it, but they certainly spoke it.
You note, I think, in the introduction to the book that yours isn't a traditional academic work. And I mentioned this a little bit in the introduction. What led you to writing the book in the particular way that you did, with few footnotes but an extensive bibliography and with stories that are carefully researched but also really sort of lovingly translated? Why did you write the book the way that you did?
I really wrote the book for trade publication, but no trade publisher wanted it, and I don't think they really understood what it was supposed to be, they didn't understand what kind of audience would read this, and because I'm an academic and I was talking to friends, and it was suggested that I submit this to an academic press. And Stanford looked at it, and they were very interested in it, in part because academic presses are doing all kinds of things to get more readers. And, one of the things I did by writing it the way I did, without footnotes and translating it as closely as possible to convey the sensibility of the Yiddish press, was to try and get a broader readership to convey that very sensibility that the Yiddish press provided. It's impossible to do in English, but I did what I could, and I hope that the stories are engaging and interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And what did you learn about Yiddish world, a world in which you've spent a lot of time as a researcher. How did the writing of the book change your view or reform or enhance your knowledge of that world?
Well, it didn't really reform my knowledge of the world, but it did change it because it really gave me a perspective that I didn't have before. I didn't, you know, the sort of, you know, average workaday Jews who appear in, you know, the crime blotter of the Yiddish press, I never really considered. I didn't think of them as you know, as a possibility for research. And I didn't, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, the sort of great masses of any culture exist, but it's sort of hard to put your finger on them because when you're working as a historian, what you want is a paper trail. So when, you know, when you go to choose a dissertation topic, or if you go to choose a topic to write about, you're going to typically people choose individuals. They'll choose, you know, scholars or artists or writers, or politicians, people who have correspondence and books that they, and manuscripts and things that they've written that you can really sink your teeth into, you know, in a scholarly way. So what, you know, the people that I'm working on don't have that. They don't leave paper trails. You know, people, you know, these people who, you know, appear in the crime blotter or, you know, or in these newspapers that, you know, sometimes the little articles that you find in the Yiddish papers are all, that's all you'll find. You won't even, you know, even if you look, you won't find a follow up. So, you know, it's all very fleeting. And the reality is if it weren't for Yiddish journalists, you know, we would know nothing at all about these people.
Right. And you talk some about these journalists. Can you say more about who they were? Because apparently they were not, you know, just hacks or scribes. They were, in many cases, playwrights and novelists and great writers of various kinds making a living.
Right, right. So in the world of Yiddish letters, it was very rare to be able to subsist just on, you know, writing novels or poetry alone. I mean, it's like any, you know, any novelist or any poet, you know, it's impossible. You have to have a day job, and that day job for many writers was working as journalists in the Yiddish press. So people like Isaac Bashevis Singer, his brother Israel Joshua Singer, almost every Yiddish writer that you can think of also worked as a journalist. So as a result, there are articles in the Yiddish press that are exceptionally well written. There's a chapter in my book in which I translated an Israel Joshua Singer story, and he has a whole, you know, he writes a huge number of articles that appear often in the forwards, but also in the Yiddish press in Poland, and his prose is often beautifully rendered. And the reality is, though, that in the Yiddish press you have things that are, you know, beautifully written, and it runs the gamut to things that are, you know, not particularly well written. You know, journalists are under, you know, they you know, work under deadlines. You know, they have to get things out quickly. You know, some articles are clearly more important than others, and they spend more time on them. Some get edited more than others. And, you know, so for instance, in, you know, larger articles, you know, they'll be better written. And in the crime blotter articles, which are more like little blurbs, they won't be as well written, but they still have a certain style and a certain snarkiness that is really unlike any other press I've seen, especially from that time period. It's really sort of a unique aspect of Yiddish journalism. There's a kind of snark and humor that comes across in a lot of articles that you wouldn't find elsewhere.
What did the readers of the Yiddish press hunger for? In other words, how did the publishers and writers of the Yiddish press feed the appetite of the readers with what they really wanted?
Well, you know, they did so in various ways, and different readers wanted different things. You know, you have politically engaged readers who you know, want more, you know, material on politics. You have the people who are into it for, you know, let's say material in the crime blotter and pulp novels. You have other people who want to read, high quality literature. And the literature aspect is also an interesting thing about the Yiddish press. The Yiddish press functioned very much as an important vehicle for Yiddish literature. Hundreds, I don't know, maybe even thousands of Yiddish stories were serialized in Yiddish newspapers, really all over the world. And readers, you know, waited for their, you know, their serialized novels. They would, you know, sometimes you would buy a paper just to read the stories by whatever writer you were interested in. You also had an aspect where people often read more than one newspaper a day. For instance, I mean, today, I can only liken this today to something like flipping through TV channels. People often watch, I think most people only watch, will watch more than one TV channel. They'll flip through channels. They'll go from show to show. If reading and if newspapers are the only form of mass media, if they're if these things are the only thing coming out every day, and you have time to read, more than likely you're gonna read more than one paper. And there was a lot of sort of trading papers. For instance, in New York, the Forwards had their print run was something around 200. In the early 1920s, their print run was something like 220,000. But their readership was actually much larger because each paper had more, typically had more than one reader. You would give, when you finished your paper, you would give it to your neighbor, or you would give it to the person next to you in the sweatshop you were working in. That was very typical, and people traded papers and read them. I don't think that people were really beholden to certain papers, although some certainly were for political reasons. But most weren't. People would read all kinds of things because that's really all there was.
There are many stories in the book. Which is the story that really stays with you the most?
That's hard to say. It's almost an unfair question. Because the stories, the stories are just amazing, and they always lead into other stories. But one of the stories I like the most is the story about the Miss Judea beauty pageant that took place in Warsaw in 1929. And what I like about that is it brings in almost every precinct of Warsaw Jewry, from the ultra Orthodox, the Chassidim, to Polish speaking Jews, to Yiddish speaking Jews, to artists, to average Jews. It's an amazing story. It's so odd.
And it does really reveal the cultural diversity of this world in a most amazing way. And the other aspect of the book that really impressed me was how central the Beis Din was to the life of even Jews who were stridently secular. Can you say a little bit about that?
Right. Well, if you needed to get divorced, well, if your marriage had gone south and you wanted to get divorced, you generally went to the Beis Din. You went to the rabbinical court because in order to get remarried, especially for women, you needed a get. You needed a Jewish writ of divorce. And so that's why people went there. It was also the cheapest place to get a divorce. Sometimes you could go to a person who you'd call a Vinklerov or a corner rabbi, which is sort of like the rabbi down the street who could also give you a get. But typically, you know, people were aware of the rabbinical divorce law, rabbinical court, and that's where they knew that it had certain hours and that you could show up there anytime and get an instant divorce if you needed it. You know, it was something that was available. So that's why people went there.
So what will you do next?
That's a good question. I do have a day job. So I'm working arduously at YIVO. You know, there's been talk of possibly doing a second volume of material like this. I do have enough material. It's very plentiful. And you know, to be honest, it's a lot of fun to work with. So that's something that I may consider doing.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to speak with us today about this rich and wonderful tapestry of Yiddish culture. I've been speaking today with Eddie Portnoy, the author of Bad Rabbi and Other Strange But True Stories from the Yiddish Press, published by Stanford University Press in 2017. Eddie, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.